Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Politics is the focus of today's show, and in just a moment, we'll chat with April Baumgarten, a reporter from The Forum. April and her colleagues at The Forum broke the story on the text messages between Senator Ray Holmberg and Nicholas Morgan DeRozier that led to yesterday's plea deal signed by Senator Holmberg, where he will voluntarily plead guilty to a charge of traveling with intent to engage in illicit sexual activity. But let's start today's show with a fascinating discussion that connects politics and weather. We'll delve into how even weather has become a political issue as we chat with North Dakota's new state climatologist, Darrell Richardson. In addition to his new role, Richardson continues to serve as the director of the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network. And as we welcomed Darrell to Main Street, we asked him how he became the state climatologist and what the responsibilities and significance of this position are.
I will say, first of all, you know, I became the state climatologist for, you know, really kind of tragic reasons. Our former state climatologist, Dr. Hughes, passed away from cancer earlier in the year. So I always like to say I wished I got the position under better circumstances on that. But, you know, the role can be so much or so little, really, in many ways, depending on what you want to make of it. You know, my focus is going to be really working with other agencies, probably public relations, just communicating things out to the public, but data integrity in the state of North Dakota. How good is our climate record? Going back through that climate record, checking some stuff, checking our stats. We do write on the state climate office monthly stats, monthly statistics. We'll work probably the thing in agriculture that people will notice the most is the state climatologist in North Dakota, at least, does have a role in the drought monitor. A lot of federal funding is associated with the drought monitor. The drought monitor has positives and negatives, like a lot of things in life, but really try to focus, and I've done that in the last couple of months, to make it as accurate as possible. You're never going to be perfect in something like that, but if there is a federal disaster that might need to be put somewhere in the state, a lot of times the governor's office would ask the state climatologist, you know, for to write those reports to help out what actually happened in those regards too. So really, you could go on and on about it, but those are some of the principal things starting off.
Do you look forward like a year, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years in what you do in your office?
I serve two roles. Now, I was interim for several months as the state climatologist, but now I am the state climatologist, but I'm also the director of the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network. Intermixed with that, I'm a meteorologist. And for the past couple of decades, I've spoken to thousands upon thousands of people, and a lot of times in the winter, I spend time discussing my logic as to why I think this upcoming growing season is going to be either X or Y. A lot of times I think it's going to be wet, dry, you know, what is the anticipation? That will sometimes help people make some plans. My track record is reasonably good at that, but that's more of a meteorological role. So really, me, I'm serving a meteorological role, which is forward thinking, and a climatological role, which historically is more of looking backwards, you know, and they do interact, you know, in some ways, because you can learn a lot from the past about what's going to happen in the future as well.
You made a comment to me just before we started the interview that the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network, NDON, is really almost a kept secret.
You know, sometimes it is. The agricultural community generally knows that it's there, but I run into farmers and ranchers in the state that don't know of its existence. The North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network is a network now of, as of this interview, of 202 like full stations, and then we have 12 rain gauge only sites. And what NDON does, principle, is we're monitoring the weather throughout the state of North Dakota. We're also working with the state of Minnesota. We have a small contingent of stations in eastern Montana, especially the northeast
of
the state.
And these stations measure temperature, precipitation, wind speed, humidity, those types of things?
Rainfall, and it's also a soil moisture network. This network is one of the largest such networks on the planet. We monitor all these conditions 24/7, 365, every 5 minutes. And what we can do in turn in agriculture, for example, is really make projections on, say, crop diseases. We know because of the weather that this particular disease, usually fungal diseases, say the big sugar beet industry in the Red River Valley, to forecast and give them a hint of when Cercospora, the main fungal disease that affects sugar beets, is going to impact their crop. The thing is, they get out and they spray, you know, it's millions of dollars, say, for the Crystal Sugar Cooperative, if everyone has to go out and spray. If we can save just one spraying, we're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not in the millions of dollars. Or if we have to spray again, yeah, there's an output on that, but there's a net return on that investment with higher yields, more poundage of sugar per acre. We do that for other diseases. We can forecast, say, when a certain insect is going to come out. Okay, this insect is very likely going to come out in the next few days. Therefore, you can get that insecticide out there to protect that crop ahead of time and perhaps use a little bit less, which is a net savings for the farmers and a somewhat of a net benefit for the environment as well. So we were able to do that. Soil moisture, the Red River Valley flooding. What was the soil conditions in the fall? What are the soil conditions in the spring? Is the ground thawed? Okay, past couple of these springs, the ground was thawed. Therefore, in turn, we got more absorption. The river levels are going to be a little bit less. Last Christmas, you know, everyone thinks, oh, it was an open winter, it was a dry winter. Fargo had the second wettest winter on record last year. It was crazy wet.
We weren't covered in snow.
Correct, but we were covered with rain that you don't see. There, what you may recall, the river, Red River, and the southern Red River Valley in particular, was going up. Well, the ground was not frozen yet because it was such a mild winter. Please don't, anyone listening to this, I'm not picking on anyone. It's a hard job. The flood forecast was much higher than what actually happened. It was because the ground wasn't frozen. And so if the ground was frozen, their forecast would have been pretty good. It wasn't. And, you know, our data could have been used there, and it was used a little bit, and then they got the forecast a little bit better. But it's these simple things. We're working on a project with the Upper Missouri River Basin for spring flooding. We're working with agriculture. We've done a large project for the oil industry in Western North Dakota and in agriculture. Of course, we work with the National Weather Service on all of this data as well. And really end on, so much of this is a value proposition, or if you want to think of it as a return on investment, because we can save money understanding and knowing the past and current weather conditions.
What is it that the energy industry is interested in from your office?
Believe it or not, gravel roads. And you might be amazed by that. But so much of the Bakken and what's happening, the infrastructure is on a gravel road. They have to get to the pads on a gravel road. They have to get oil from gravel road. The wastewater is on a gravel road. So historically, the big four counties out there, say McKenzie, Dunn, Montreal, and Williams County, they're large counties. These are like, you know, Rhode Island, Connecticut-sized counties in a way. It would rain, and they would close down all the county gravel roads in the sense of weight limits, you know, like frost limits. And so the big trucks couldn't get out there. So the oil well sat there, and you couldn't go out there and do it. Sometimes they'd have to shut them down, or they couldn't go down there. So, of course, they're not getting the oil. In turn, you know, revenue is going to drop. Mineral rights are going to drop. Tax dollars are going to drop. So what we did is we worked with the big four counties in particular is, okay, we put up 50 stations, all these rain gauges, plus they have cameras on it to monitor the gravel roads. How are the gravel roads? What do they look like? Do we have to shut down traffic? Oh, it only rained in zone one. It didn't rain, say, in zone two, three, four, and five. We'll keep all of those open. So it's already estimated that that has saved tens of millions of dollars, which of course is, again, tax revenue, profits, mineral rights, a huge value proposition it ended up being. So it was a huge return on investment. So it seems odd, but weather is a big factor in all of that, to the point where other states, oh, maybe, you know, we should do something like that. I've been already contacted about. So that's another odd example of looking and doing weather data, how in turn that small investment oftentimes brings very large returns.
How do you communicate what you do to ag, to energy, to other agencies that have a need for your data?
I do a lot of public speaking. I'm on the phone a lot. I don't sleep a lot. I think in two words to say that it's public relations in the sense that you have to be out there promoting, speaking, giving people this information that's out there. Your name, your words, to get out there, and then people communicate back with me. You know, the day we did this interview, I had 4 phone calls this morning dealing with these issues and people asking, you know, about what they can do. Do you have X or Y for me? Because we need it for all of these different reasons. And that's part of being the director of the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network, but it's also part of being the state climatologist for North Dakota. You're the keeper, you know, of the data. You know, the Forum newspaper in Fargo a lot of times asks me, because I have the old record books from Moorhead, more so than Fargo, from the 18 and early 1900s, the old diaries that I have, that I can go in there and they might ask a question, why did this, you know, was there, they say something about the weather, what was actually going on? Well, the high was 10 and the low was 5 below, and there was a trace of snow. Well, that doesn't sound like much, but when you read the diaries, it would be some odd things would be in there. You know, the wind picked up a lot at 2 o'clock in this afternoon and caused blowing snow, which is a bigger deal then than it even is here. But even nowadays, it's going to cause traffic problems or whiteouts and conditions like that. So there's all these little subtle things in those record books that you can find that now we're telling the story, but it impacted them in the past. And truth be told, of course, it still impacts us today.
Enjoying our conversation with Daryl Richeson. He is the new state climatologist for the state of North Dakota. Daryl, you talked about historical data. What have you learned about trends that you've recognized about weather here in North Dakota?
Our oldest records, continuous records, are in Bismarck, and they started on October 1st of 1874. So really, first full year is 1875. The second oldest records are in Fargo, and they started on January 1st, 1881. Fargo's records are continuous. There's a small time frame in January, I do believe I should know this, but I think it was 1887 that's missing. And I've forever been here for almost 30 years. Like, why was those days missing? And I finally found the answer. The one reporter had the flu.
and he was the person in charge.
He was the person, and there was no one else to do it. So we're missing those days. And Bismarck's record's more continuous, but missing 5 days out of 140 years. It's pretty good. You know, you look through there, you'll just see trends. You'll see patterns. You'll see periods of wet. You'll see periods of dry. You'll see periods cool years followed by hot years. Really, what you learn is what anyone that lives in the Northern Plains here finds out after a couple of years. We live in a highly variable climate, and we can go from one extreme to the next very, very quickly. And the record book just gives you more demonstrations of that. And then before our records, you know, there's proxy data. I mean, Lewis and Clark were here back in the day, early 1800s, of course, 1804 and 1806 when they came on through those 2 years. And there's Voyagers, some records, and other proxy data, you know, that we learn. We have, you know, fairly good proxy data, Devil's Lake. Devil's Lake has gone dry in the last 1,200 years. Devil's Lake has flown over the banks and gone naturally into the Cheyenne River, which, of course, we've been trying to prevent recently. You know, really what I learned is there's nothing new under the sun. Yeah, things fluctuate now. Well, they've pretty much always have done that.
Daryl, I want to talk to you about climate change. From this perspective, there are many people that think climate change is very real, that we should be very concerned. There are other people that believe that climate change may be something less to worry about. We're in cyclical weather. We've always been that way. So from your office, what is your message to people and what should they know about discussing climate change?
That is such a difficult thing to answer because I tend to look at things very much from a scientific perspective. Climate change, like many other topics in our society, has really turned into a political discussion. And so in turn, no matter what you say about that topic, there's people that get really angry with me. And that always frustrates me because to me, it's like, oh, come on, people. Allow people to have a different opinion. Be allowed to be open-minded and understand things. There's so much catastrophizing, if I can say that correctly, that goes on. You know, it's summer, it's hot. No, this has never happened before. Yes, it has. It was hotter in the past than it has been recently. You know, the facts just stick that out. But you say that to some individuals, they get very, very, you know, angry with you. And then if you say, well, you know, humans do have some impact, it's just a matter of how much it is, you know, you might anger the people that say, well, we have absolutely no impact. I like sticking with facts, to me, in many ways that aren't arguable, but a lot of times even that, you know, people will argue with me that I'm wrong. And I go, well, here's the data. You look at it. You know, it's science. Please be open-minded. and understand there's no such thing as a consensus in science. That word should never be used. Always open to new ideas. You're always open to being wrong on an issue and an experimentation. If you would have told me when I started my career nearly 35 years ago that my job would be so political and people would get so angry, I would have kind of gone, no, that will never happen in my career. But that's what it comes. So you have to be very, very careful. I will just always, you know, and in this interview, you know, emphasize to people, no matter where you are in that perspective on things, is to keep an open mind. We don't know. And anyone who says otherwise to me is not a very good scientist, because we don't know things for sure. Most of the evidence suggests that any changes will be mild and be easily handled by our technology with humans. But again, just me saying that, I will probably, someone will listen to this and write me I'll be honest, hopefully not a nasty email about that. And I'm just going, well, read 500 research papers and you might find out something a little bit different. Again, it's hard for me to answer these questions because it's so polarizing now, going back and forth. But I try to stick with the facts, stick with an open mind. And I'm also one of those, I don't know everything and I never will. So I respect your opinion. I may disagree with it. Please respect my opinion because you may disagree with that. It goes both ways.
In your 35 years that you've been working in this field, I have to believe technology is massively changed what you're doing today versus what you were doing 35 years ago. Has it? And are there examples?
I think probably the best example is, you know, there's temperature records from the 1600s. They're not the same temperature records we have today. And, you know, that is one of the issues, you know, you always have to remember with any climate change thing is we're not measuring things apples to apples anymore. The thing about to go kind of change it to this is Endon, for example, we're referenced as a mesonet. You know, so meso is in meteorological terms, Greek word really for middle. So there's mesoscale weather. And think of mesoscale weather, you'll get slightly different definitions. I always like looking at it as think of a county or two. A thunderstorm would be like a way of a mesoscale weather event. A lot of times tornadoes form out of a mesocyclone that's within that thunderstorm. So that's mesoscale weather. But all of our stations to be a true mesonet. This site over here is always seems to be 3/4 of a degree warmer than this area. Well, big deal. No, it's a big deal because at 3/4 of a degree over 110-day growing season, that crop over there gets a lot more heat units and it's going to mature faster, might bring better yields. Very, very subtle things. But is it 3 to 4/4 of a degree difference because, or a degree different because of the equipment? It easily could because every piece of equipment has different specs. All of our equipment's exactly alike, calibrated exactly the same. Therefore, if that area is warmer than this area, it's because that area is just warmer. Slight elevation change, a little bit more wind, different soil type, different ground vegetation. You know, all of those factors come into play, which again, subtle changes means a lot in agriculture. So to get to your question then with that backdrop is, well, when I started 35 years ago, how would you get 200 weather stations data onto a computer screen that you can watch it instantaneously all the time?
And now you can.
And now you can. And probably the thing in forecasting is when I started my career, a 3-day forecast was probably that third day was approximately as accurate now as a 7-day forecast. So I could go out and tell you on a Monday that this weekend looks this way. Is it going to be perfect? Of course not. And you're not going to hit it all the time. But I always like using this term. It's useful. It's usable. It's useful data. It's not perfect. It's useful data. You know, all of my stations, no such thing as perfection, but it's very, very useful. So a 7-day forecast now is useful. When I started the career, 7-day forecast was a dart throw, you know, as an example. And a 3-day forecast then was useful, but, you know, things happen. So probably just processing and computer power, probably the thing I would say was the most changes in the last 35 years.
Give me an idea about the staff that you work with, either with Endon or through the State Climate Office.
Well, I will say the state climate office is Daryl Richeson.
That's you.
That's just
you're me. The staff.
I'm the
CEO.
I'm the staff of that. But I have a staff that works for the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network. I have a number of programmers. I'll have a lot of field staff. For example, this summer, I have right now 7 summer staff, college students for the most part, that are working for me this summer. We go around the state because all these stations have to be maintained. The equipment has to be calibrated. The equipment has to be replaced. We have to do the basic stuff of just trimming them. One of my staff in particular for Endon has helped me quite a bit. With the state climate office, because there's a lot of things to do, you know, with my other responsibilities. As I can find, say, grant monies and other things around, you know, I can hire some staff off of that. And
are you primarily grant funded, or do you have some more public dollars that assist what you do?
The great thing about Endon historically, until very recently, is that we're a public-private partnership. And so in that sense, you know, my salary, for example, right now is 100% supported with tax dollars because, you know, NDSU employees are technically state employees in that sense of the word. Recently, then, that's the public part. The private part would be for really the first almost 30 years of existence of Endon. And Endon, by the way, started in 1989 by Dr. John Enns, the former state climatologist before the one that just passed away. And he, sadly, Dr. Enns, also passed away very recently. So our past 2 state climatologists passed away this year, sadly. But he started Endon in 1989. And what would happen, it'd be that this group of farmers or this individual, but it's usually a group of farmers or a grain elevator with some farmers. Sometimes I've had 30 plus people all throw money, give us checks and go, Daryl, we want a weather station here. So they would buy that weather station. Then we would put it where, for the most part, where they wanted to, if it fit my criteria or Endon's criteria. Then every year they, and this still happens, they will send us a check for the maintenance fee. We have cell bills. I have a cell bill of 225 station cell phones.
How you communicate, right?
And we communicate back and forth. So if you think your cell bill is too high, I have the equivalent of 225 cell phones I have to pay for every month. But that's how we communicate. But they give us maintenance and then money to replace the equipment and stuff. Recently now, really since about 2020, I have gotten a lot of more government support. The Army Corps of Engineers, I got a $7.1 million grant from them. For instance, the Red River Joint Water Resource District, I've gotten about $350,000 to put all season rain gauges so we can measure the liquid in the snow so we have a better idea of the flooding. The Metro Diversion Authority has given me $250,000 to put these all season gauges because even when the diversion's done, it's not like, oh, let's hit a light switch and turn on that diversion. It's a little bit more complicated than that. So they still have to be prepped. They have to know what's coming through the system, how much precipitation has fallen. And so then I've gotten other grants as well. The state of North Dakota does fund me not only for salaries, but I do get, you know, a small stipend of taxpayer dollars to run the network too. As you can imagine, with the staff and that many stations, it does cost quite a bit of money to keep us up and running.
Can people look at this data in real time like you can? Is there a website that we can go to?
Most definitely. There's 2 websites and everyone goes, why is it 2, Daryl? And I go, we're working on it. They get it all together into one. And the reason there's 2 is we have our main website that's been around for a long time. It does a great job if you're on a computer or a tablet. But if you're on a phone, it's not mobile compliant and it's really hard to use. It has a longer address that can get confusing to people. So the easiest way to get on our older website is just type in Endon, Endawn.org, and that will direct you. And when you type that in, it'll direct you to a map of all the current conditions. And that map in front of you will change every 5 minutes to new temperatures. And there's a little tab on the bottom that you a whole bunch of parameters. And if you look on the side menus, there's soil, there's a whole bunch of stuff on there. If you go to Endon, Endawn again, .info, which is weird for people to type in. They're used to com or org, but this is .info. It'll take you to a mobile compliance site, and that's why the difference works great on your phone. And if you look on the top, usually on websites on your phone, if it has a menu that's just 3 dash lines is the universal symbol, that's a menu.
The hamburger.
Yeah, and I never thought of it that way. That's a good one.
Daryl Richeson. He's the new state climatologist for North Dakota and also the director of Endon, the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A bit later in the show, Chuck Lura will tell us about the hidden treasure in North Central North Dakota, the International Peace Garden. That's coming in his Natural North Dakota essay. And precision agriculture has promised to revolutionize farming since the mid-1990s. The idea is to give growers more granular data about their operations and new technology to put that information to use. Farmers have more sophisticated equipment and hard data on how their operations perform, as we'll hear in a report from Eric Schmid of Harvest Public Media. But next, former North Dakota State Senator Ray Holmberg has signed an agreement indicating that he will plead guilty to a child sex tourism charge. A plea agreement filed in the United States District Court Monday says Holmberg will voluntarily plead guilty to a charge of traveling with intent to engage in illicit sexual activity. Holmberg was set to go to trial in Fargo in September, and a date has yet to be set for his plea hearing. April Baumgarten is a reporter, and she and her colleagues at the forum broke the story that began when text messages between Senator Holmberg and Nicholas Morgan DeRozier were discovered, and that led to where we are today. April, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
April, remind us who Ray Holmberg was politically.
So Ray Holmberg was a senator in the North Dakota Senate. He was one of the most powerful senators, if not one of the most powerful lawmakers in the Senate. He was the chair for the Appropriations Committee, which gives out money to all the different government agencies. Is the head of something called legislative management, which decides what committees every lawmaker sits on, what potential bills to take up during special sessions, and what studies to look at between sessions. And then also, he was the longest serving state senator in the U.S. at the time of his retirement in 2022.
How did you come to learn, April, about the text messages that seems to me that started this road that we ended on with yesterday that we'll talk more about here in just a moment?
So we got a pretty vague tip to saying that there was a political leader somewhere in North Dakota that was involved in some type or could be involved in some type of federal case. And we were told to just watch federal cases, watch documents, something's going to come up. Well, I was looking at one case involving Nicholas Morgan DeRozier. He's a Grand Forks man who was accused of distributing child sex abuse materials and bringing children from the Twin City area to have sex with them in his Grand Forks home. So while before all the federal charges happen, Morgan DeRozier is sitting in jail. We find out in his detention hearing that he's texting a 77-year-old Grand Forks man, asking him to, 77-year-old man asked Morgan DeRozier to bring over his 19 to 20-year-old boyfriend for a massage. What we did was see if we could get the phone list of people that Morgan DeRozier contacted on this particular date, which was in August 2021. And aside from attorneys and bailiffs, the only number that matched someone else was the former number of Ray Holmberg. At least it was once listed on his legislative bio. We also got a log of all the text messages that were sent back and forth on these 2 days. It was 72 messages, a lot of them within just hours of each other.
Was that the, oh my gosh, moment for you that, okay, this tip now makes sense?
Yeah, it absolutely was, because why would some lawmaker be in contact with someone who is charged with some type of sex crimes? And so we did go to Ray Holmberg and ask him, hey, this is what we found. We found that you were texting this guy multiple times, and it fits the what prosecutors said of a 77-year-old Grand Forks man texting Morgan DeRozier about this massage, which in itself is not that bad, but it does raise some questions of what this man and what Ray Holmberg have in common or what connection they have.
Was Senator Holmberg still in office at the time?
He was. So this would have been in April 2022, I believe. And we asked him what we were texting about. He denied the massage. He said they were texting about patio work and other things. He had been doing some patio, or Morgan DeRozier had been doing some patio work for Ray Holmberg. And that actually was kind of the crux of this whole investigation into Morgan DeRozier, was scamming customers through a construction fraud case. And that's how police actually found evidence of sex crimes being committed with Morgan DeRozier. And so he denied the massage. And then we asked, can you show us the text messages? And he said, they're just gone.
How did your reporting then progress?
There were some other allegations that came out that he was having sex with young men. And eventually, Holmberg decided that he was going to resign early. He always intended to retire at the end of 2022. It came a time where he felt that this reporting was interfering with his work as a legislator and also distracting from legislation in general. So he decided to resign in June 2022. About a year later, we find out that Morgan DeRozier asked for Ray Holmberg for a ride to Bismarck for so he could do an interview with Consumer Protection about his construction fraud case. There was other police reports linking Ray Holmberg and Morgan DeRozier together, including a theft case where allegedly Morgan DeRozier or some of his men stole money from Ray Holmberg. But no charges came out of that because Senator Holmberg declined to press charges.
When was the last time you had a chance to visit with Senator Holmberg?
I believe it was sometime in 2022. It was sometime between he resigned and when we did a story about him in August of 2022, that his house had been searched by Homeland Security. And that's when we found out that there was items taken from Mr. Holmberg's house, including a cell phone, which is probably why he didn't have that cell phone number anymore. He got a new one. Also, a laptop was taken, but since mid-2022, we haven't spoken to him since. He's asked us not to contact him about it or to refer it to his attorney, Mark Fries.
When did you begin to understand that federal charges are imminent?
It was probably about that time when we found out that his home had been searched. It's pretty rare for Homeland Security or any police department in general to not get a search warrant that is not going to result in some type of charges. It does happen. It just seemed that at some point within the next year of that search being revealed to us that there was going to be some charges coming down. We just didn't know what.
And then here they came.
Yeah, they came in October, late October of 2023. Turns out that he was accused of traveling to Prague to have sexually abuse a minor, and then also receiving and attempting to receive, as the charges laid out, child sex abuse material.
April, when you're writing about this, and you consider that the alleged victim is a minor and that it is an sexual assault, does the language that you use cross your mind? To many, to some, that might be he tried to rape or he was raping an underage person. That's a hard word. Did you think about the language that you wanted to use to articulate this story to your readers?
Absolutely. We really thought about that for quite a bit, and we actually consulted some people about what would be the proper language to use, including some prosecutors. Typically, sometimes the charges have not been updated to what modern language is. For example, in a lot of court cases, you'll find child porn instead of child sex abuse materials. And porn has a connotation that someone is willing to do that, where a child can never consent. As far as the sex with a minor, we did change that to sexually abusing a minor because, again, child cannot consent. We did talk about the age of consent in Prague, which is actually 16. But after talking with prosecutors, that doesn't really matter. It's you are making these decisions in the U.S., you're making plans, you're traveling to another country to sexually abuse someone who is 18 or under in another country. And so that's why we decided on that language.
Do we know today if that person was 12, was 15, or was a boy or was a girl?
We know that they were just 18 years and under. And I would have to check the court documents again, but I don't believe a gender was disclosed.
So we come to a plea deal. It was signed yesterday. Did you have a sense of surprise? It was scheduled for trial in September that it didn't go to trial.
I think the biggest surprise was not so much the plea deal. It's that how soon it came. Some of these cases can take over a year to even get to a plea deal. With this type of complicated case where you're traveling across international boundaries dealing with computers, it could take much longer than a year to just to even figure out all the discovery, all the evidence, all the testimony. So I was quite surprised that we got this in less than 9 months of the charges being brought.
What were the details of the plea deal as you understand it?
So this is what we understand from the plea deal. He's pleading guilty to that traveling with intent to sexually abuse a child charge. The child sex abuse materials charge is going to be dismissed. I believe that the travel charge does carry a heavier penalty. The maximum is 30 years in prison. However, because of his lack of criminal history, he's going to be sentenced on the lower end of the guidelines. And what I mean by that is Congress has set up a set of different timelines and lengths of sentences based on your criminal history, other conduct, how serious the conduct was, and if there's any true remorse in a case. So we're looking at about 37 months to 46 months. That's what the prosecutors and the defense have agreed.
This was a federal charge. Potentially, he could still face maybe state charges someday or civil charges someday under the purview of this plea agreement.
It's possible the civil side. I'd highly doubt the state side, because once you adjudicate something on the federal, the state kind of lets that federal prosecution take over. If there was another victim or a different type of crime, of course, we want to avoid double jeopardy, but if there was another type of crime or another victim, we could see more charges, but I think this is probably going to be the crux of it.
April, what is your perception of how the public has reacted towards this, either from the moment the charges were filed clear until now?
There was definitely a lot of shock initially, especially when we first started our reporting. Some people were wondering, how could this man who had done so much for North Dakota, particularly in Grand Forks, he got a lot of funding for Grand Forks, and he was very well known for working across the aisle. So he was a very trusted figure, very respected figure in North Dakota politics. So there was understandably a lot of question about why or how could someone of this much respect be charged with a crime like this, or even be capable of something so sinister. There also was a lot of doubt and pushback. There also was other people who were not quite surprised that they had some inkling something was going on, but maybe not criminal. I think as the case has progressed, some attitude have changed, but I think people are still very much questioning what happened and why did this happen.
Is there anything comparative in North Dakota's history that comes to your mind that you're aware of, April?
At this moment, the closest I could think is actually in another state, in South Dakota, where the attorney general had hit and killed someone on the road while driving. He was removed from office, I believe, but In North Dakota history, it's hard for me to remember something like where a public official was involved. The closest that we have that is even more current is Jason Doctor, who, not quite related, but connected to this case as well, because he's connected through Wayne Steningem and doing a building deal in Bismarck for space for the BACI. And he was convicted of using his power as a lawmaker to speculate on getting that funding through the legislature to make money off of that deal.
April Baumgarten, a former Jamestown Jimmy. She joined the forum in February of 2019 as an investigative reporter. She, along with her colleagues, really broke this story to all of us. And April, thanks for your reporting on this, and thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Sleepy Hollow Arts Park in Bismarck invites you to enjoy the timeless magic of Cinderella with this modern Broadway-style version, July 11th through the 20th at 8 p.m. nightly. It's live with a large cast and orchestra full of energy and talent, supported by professional lights, sound, costumes, all set in an outdoor amphitheater. Gates open at 6:30 with food trucks, games, and a pre-show by Rising Stars. Tickets available at Eckroth Music, most subways, or online at shtap.org.
Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Precision agriculture has promised to revolutionize farming since the mid-1990s. The idea is to give growers more granular data about their operations and new technology to put that information to use. Some of this has come to pass. Farmers now have more sophisticated equipment and hard data on how their operations perform, as we hear in this report from Eric Schmid of Harvest Public Media.
Inside the basement of an old brick building in South St. Louis, a small team of scientists make the final adjustments to a new sensor. It employs a powerful laser to determine the elements and even some molecules that are in front of it.
All right, targets in place.
Firing in 3, 2, 1.
This may sound a little like a rocket launch, but it's actually a prototype machine that can measure soil composition in real time. Pablo Sobrón is the founder of Impossible Sensing.
And every clack, 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 every light bullet that you heard gives you a data point.
Data points on nutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, even water conditions and indicators of soil health. The sensor can be mounted on the back of a planter to let farmers see exactly what's happening in their soil as they drive through a field. Sobrón says that could help farmers apply the exact amount of fertilizer each plant needs.
The real value and the real need here is to give insights, give knowledge, prescribe what to do when.
Sobrón says this is the promise of precision ag, that knowing what's happening with individual plants will boost productivity and reduce the overuse of fertilizer, which pollutes rivers, lakes, and groundwater. But he says the hype hasn't delivered, at least not yet. And Sobrón isn't the only person working on it. Allison Doyle is an associate director at the Iowa State University Research Park. She says big ag companies are also looking beyond just seeds, fertilizer, and traditional farm equipment.
There's a trend right now in agriculture where a lot of the ag companies are positioning themselves more in the tech space than they are traditional ag.
She says labor is a big driver of this. There aren't as many people farming now than there were in the past. And Doyle says today's farms are much bigger than they used to be.
When you have an operation that large where commodity prices and all the input prices are where they are, you're looking for a tiny little bit of margin wherever you can find it, and so those precision tools become necessary.
But however promising new tools like that laser are, it'll likely take years for them to be adopted on thousands, let alone millions of farming acres.
Experimentation is a risk.
Bill Lee farms about 2,200 acres of corn and soybeans with his brother in central Illinois. Since he started farming in 1982, he says he's slowly added more precision tools to make his operation more efficient, whether applying fertilizer or planting seeds.
It's not a jump in with both feet, it's a process, because it's just too expensive and there's too much at risk to take that flying leap and realize there's not a high jump pit at the end, it's a piece of concrete.
Lee says he's more than willing to spend money on new technology, as long as he sees an economic return. It's a financial equation many farmers are familiar with. Chad Zimmerman, agri-food director at the nonprofit BioSTL in St. Louis, says it's unfair to expect farmers to be the only ones to bear the financial uncertainty that can come with changing their practices.
We can't be asking them to take on more risk, to just take a decrease in their profit to accomplish somebody else's goal.
Zimmerman says new agricultural technology can help growers, but it won't fully deliver the cost and environmental benefits until scaled across millions of acres. Impossible Sensing's Sobrón says that means big and small companies have to be the ones to prove their precision ag tech really works.
It's on us, right, to really create that value and show it.
He says once farmers see that value demonstrated, they'll adopt those new practices en masse, which is what he expects will happen with his new sensor in a few years. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Eric Schmid in St. Louis.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in veteran and active duty home loans. Bill can be reached at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Chuck Lura in this natural North Dakota encourages us to visit the International Peace Garden on the border of North Dakota and Canada this summer.
Consider a trip to the International Peace Garden this summer. There's much to see and do there, including exploring a little natural North Dakota and Manitoba in the Turtle Mountain Aspen Forest. The International Peace Garden is located on the international border north of Dunseith. It's widely known for its formal gardens with over 80,000 plants, sunken garden, floral clock, and peace chapel. More recent additions include the 9/11 Memorial and the Conservatory and Interpretive Center, which contains the Don Vitko Cacti and Succulent Collection, with over 5,000 cacti and succulents from around the world. The International Music Camp is also located within the International Peace Garden. So is the North American Game Warden Wildlife Museum, which is dedicated to educating the public of the role of wildlife law enforcement and natural resources. The museum contains several taxidermy mounts and pelts, including several see and touch items. Less well known, however, is that the International Peace Garden consists of over 2,000 acres in which to explore the local flora and fauna. Be sure to drive, bike, or hike the paved 3 mile south drive to look around the North Dakota side, as well as the 3 mile north drive through the Manitoba side. Both loops traverse around a variety of habitats, including aspen forests, lakes, and marshes. The International Peace Garden also supports campgrounds and several picnic areas. There are also hiking and biking trails on which to explore the Turtle Mountain forest, lakes, and marshes. The trails are suitable for all skill levels, including the Lakeview Hiking Trail, a 1.5 mile trail, bur oak, quaking aspen, wild sarsaparilla, meadow rue, fireweed, lavender hyssop, rose-breasted grosbeaks, yellow warblers, coyotes, and beaver are among the plants and animals that may be observed. Exploring Lake Stormont by canoe or kayak is a great way to enjoy nature. Kayaks, paddles, and life jackets are available for rent. So make a point to visit the International Peace Garden this summer. I've put links to their website and other information on the International Peace Garden, along with a text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org.
That's Chuck Laura, who is a longtime biology professor at Dakota College in Botineau, where he published research on ecological aspects of grasslands in the northern Great Plains. In retirement, he continues to share his Natural North Dakota essays for the Prairie Public audience. Dakota Datebook is next.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 25th. Settlers in the Dakotas faced many challenges as they crossed the plains. There were the financial pressures as they attempted to forge a living from the prairie soils, and of course, the extreme weather conditions, with a great range in both temperature and weather patterns. The state's record high and low temps occurred in the same year, 1936. The high, fifth highest in the U.S., was an astounding 121 degrees, and the low was minus 60, a 181 degree difference. Life generally improved as more amenities found their way across the grasslands. However, there were still dangers, and the worst of them might surprise you. The Washburn Leader on February 2, 1901, stated that many more people have been killed by lightning than have been run over by stampeding buffalo herds, or killed by unwounded grizzly bears, or by all the other animals of the prairie put together. Later that year, the Dickinson Press reported that John Hansen of Willow City had been killed by lightning while driving cattle on horseback. The horse was also killed. The Botineau Courant added that everyone had been rejoicing over the rainfall, but with that rain had come tragedy. Most of the reported incidents happened out on the open prairie, where there was little tree cover for protection, but lightning could also be menacing in town. On this date, in 1901, the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican reported that Stephen Baumgartner, a Hungarian immigrant who had moved to the United States in 1899, had been killed in his home by lightning during a storm that hit the Tower City area. The elderly farmer's death was instantaneous, and nearly all his clothes were torn from his person. Two other men in the house were shocked, but suffered no serious injuries. In modern years, North Dakota lightning deaths have been exceedingly rare, with only one death in a recent 10-year period. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jacob Clausen. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that wraps up today's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful for your time and company. Join us tomorrow for an insightful interview and preview of Thursday's presidential debate between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. The interview will feature our go-to presidential historian, Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope that you'll join us.